You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Stockbridge Muncie community in Wisconsin is getting back a piece of its ancestral land in New York. We'll learn about the history of the land and how it came to be returned. Now, plans for a bipartisan infrastructure bill appear to be back on track after a bit of uncertainty over the weekend. After meeting with a group of Republican and Democratic senators on Thursday, President Biden announced that the foundation had been laid to improve the nation's roads, bridges, and broadband internet access.
And to answer your direct question, we have a deal. And I think it's really important. We've all agreed that none of us got what we all that we wanted. I clearly didn't get all I wanted. They gave more than I think maybe they were inclined to give in the first place. But this reminds me of the days we used to get an awful lot done up in the United States Congress. We actually worked with them. We had bipartisan deals. Bipartisan deals means compromise.
Hours later, Biden said he would only sign it if Congress passed a second measure that would bolster health care and child care and fight climate change. That got Republican senators worked up, but on Saturday, after some private phone calls, Biden put out a statement saying he never intended to threaten a veto. He also said he understood why Republicans were upset. So now the bipartisan plan appears to be a go, but there's no guarantee it'll make it to Biden's desk. Meanwhile, Democrats say they're going to plug away on a quote-unquote human infrastructure proposal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does infrastructure mean to you? Is it just roads, bridges, rail, airports, seaports, internet? Or does it include things like childcare, healthcare, and other measures? Do you want to see Congress pass a bipartisan bill, or do you want progressives to hold out for bigger spending on the other infrastructure stuff or not? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Joseph Sweeterman is a professor in the School for Public Service, Department of Public Policy, and Sustainable Urban Development Program at DePaul University. He's written several books, including Terminal Town, an illustrated guide to Chicago's airports, bus depots, train stations, and steamship landings, 1939 to present. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Before we dive into details, the case for infrastructure spending, it's often around this idea that we've got problems with our infrastructure. Adjectives like aging and crumbling get thrown around. Is that fair? Do we have this infrastructure problem that needs a fixing?
Oh, we certainly do. And I think what most of us have come to expect is, you know, things are so partisan in politics, but infrastructure, for the most part, has been bipartisan. You know, urban planning and things aren't something that you hear the parties, you know, divide and polarize on as much. So we expected to see the president come out with infrastructure package. But we did see his initial plan went down a path that, you know, generated strong opposition from Republicans. And of course, the Democrats were for it. And so we do have a compromise here, which is, I think, kind of good news for everybody in the sense that we see that there's a core to this bill that both parties like. And that's where we are now to see how this thing unfolds.
As you see it, Joe, is there, at the top of your laundry list for infrastructure, where would you want to see money going where it's needed the most urgently?
Well, if we look at infrastructure in the historic sense of, you know, physical improvements, we do know a couple things. One, in the interstate highway system that we've all been using, it was built in the late 50s, early 60s, so much of that is reaching the end of its useful life. Boy, it was unrelated, but a wake-up call to see that disaster in Miami. But it's just a lesson on how reinforced concrete exposed to weather, you know, can lead to just terrible outcomes. So the highway system is in sorely need of repair. With that, we do know that, you know, the standard on airports worldwide, and we had this huge surge in air travel pre-pandemic. I mean, it was like something I've never seen in my life, with 4 or 5% growth per year. So air travel is just splitting from the seams in our airports. If you've been to O'Hare here in Chicago, you know what integrated infrastructure can look like. So the airport scene needs some help. And, of course, our transit systems have fallen behind. And then you look at the other things, lead pipes and water facilities. And, boy, this comes not a moment too soon.
Are there ways to do this sustainably? I mean, like, this looks like a one-shot, throw a bunch of money in for needed repairs over whatever, 5, 8 years, depending on how it ends up shaking out. Do we need to think more about, okay, how can the airport we rebuild now still be good in 20, 30 years?
Well, that's right. I think what we're all a little surprised about is that certain parts of the president's initial bill, you know, electric power and things on the grid and so forth, were a little more divisive than we thought. So in the compromise bill, you know, we still have some funding for electric car infrastructure and so forth. But in some ways, that's low-hanging fruit that both parties agreed the future is, you know, less dependence on fossil fuel, electric technology, you know, the age-old problem of how to build batteries that last long enough to be usable. We seem to be ready to solve that problem. So we know it's ready to take off, especially, you know, ground vehicles. But, yeah, the need for sustainable solutions can be done, I think, in ways that don't generate this partisan infighting. But it wasn't a real good sign what we saw the last few weeks, that the definition of infrastructure in this bill is going to be pretty narrow and not as much in there about those environmental things as many people would have expected.
Talking to Joseph Sweeterman from DePaul University. He works on infrastructure there, looking at a bill making its way through Congress, or is an agreement agreed on with a bipartisan group of senators and the White House for an infrastructure plan narrower than the Biden administration had been asking for. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on Jeremy now, calling from Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. When it comes to infrastructure spending and bills, it should stay within those parameters of infrastructure purpose only. If you want to tack on things like health care and child's cares and things like that, it's kind of like backdoor legislation. You know, you want to get the bill passed, you want to get the budget passed, which is throwing a few of these other bills. And a lot of times the public doesn't even know what it entails. And it doesn't give the public enough time or a public forum to really discuss these bills in detail and what have you. So keep them separate, bring up those bills separately. And also part of the infrastructure should be modernizing our federal government, state, local governments, offices and buildings with internet technology, security, things like that. Let's update our offices, equipment, bring in enough people to actually handle the workloads. That to me is what infrastructure should be about.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for the call. Joe, his first point there saying, hey, let's focus, if we're calling it infrastructure, let's make it what we traditionally consider that infrastructure, the physical stuff. We've touched on that a little. What do you think?
Well, I do think the president made a miscalculation there by calling it just infrastructure when perhaps, you know, a more comprehensive term would have been infrastructure and, you know, social investment or something like that that would have not created this debate over what constitutes infrastructure, because the caller is right that the term infrastructure we use historically has been more narrowly defined, but has been broadened a bit as we get to things like solar power and that sort of thing. But the nuts and bolts things he mentioned are exactly right. And, you know, don't forget during the pandemic, local governments, it's really interesting how some, you know, are coming out almost better than they were before pandemic, but most are looking at the, you know, at the income statement and say, look, this sales tax revenue isn't going to come back anytime soon. Those upgrades we've been planning to do aren't going to happen. So, yeah, the sharing with local governments that are feeling the pinch was a bigger part of the initial bill than I think what the final bill here is looking like.
We're talking to Joseph Sweeterman, professor in the School for Public Service, Department of Public Policy and Sustainable Urban Development at DePaul University. Looking at infrastructure, an agreement for now, at least between bipartisan senators and the president looking to spend money on infrastructure, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see something happen? If so, what? Do you want this narrower focus on the roads and highways and things like that? Or do you want the human infrastructure to be part of the deal, as the Biden administration has called for it? And how about climate change? Should that factor into all of this? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about infrastructure in the U.S. President Biden said he reached a deal last week with a handful of Republican senators on a plan that would fix up roads, bridges, and broadband internet. Not a done deal yet. Joseph Sweeterman is with us, professor in the School for Public Service, Department of Public Policy and Sustainable Urban Development Program at DePaul University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tell us what you'd like to see done when it comes to infrastructure in the U.S., how far the plan should go. Do you want to see it include infrastructure defined more broadly to include what the president has called human infrastructure, childcare, things like that? Climate change, should that play a role here? Call 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to a couple senators, one from each party, talking about these issues, starting with Republican Mitt Romney on CNN yesterday, asked whether he trusts Biden after the back and forth last week. Here's a listen.
I do trust the president, and he made very clear in the much larger statement that came out over the weekend, carefully crafted and thought through piece by piece, that if the infrastructure bill reaches his desk and it comes alone, he will sign it. At the same time, I recognize that he and his Democrat colleagues want more than that. They want other legislation as well. And we Republicans are saying absolutely no. We will not support a bill which is to be passed with a massive tax increase and at the same time trillions of dollars in new spending. That is not something we will support.
And then here's Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren on Friday saying the bipartisan plan doesn't go far enough.
It's not going to be the case that there's going to be an infrastructure train that leaves the station and leaves child care behind, leaves green energy behind, leaves making billionaires and giant corporations pay their fair share. We have to have the whole thing, not just cleave off a little piece of it.
So there's the political quandary, Joe. Some progressive Democrats say, at least hinting they may not support a bill if it doesn't go far enough, and Senator Romney making it clear that they wouldn't support a bill that goes too far. Are you worried that this is all going to scuttle anything happening?
Well, I think it is intriguing to watch this, because we do know that there'll be a lot of pressure on the Biden administration to have a victory, to have some legislation come through, even if it's a compromise, given just the momentum that the president felt without a whole lot to show for it yet. So I think this one, I think will actually be, if it is approved, be good to show that there is a way for the parties to work together on things that are of common interest. You know, that said, I do think it'll be intriguing to watch, if the Democratic Party knows they have one shot at reconciliation, passed with 50 votes, that they could have another bill on social investment or the Green New Deal, those kind of things. And so they're playing their chits very carefully here, you might say, because both parties have an incentive to get the smaller bill through. The question is how that affects, legislation down the line. I think the good news here is that there's, again, some of the things that aren't in the bill, like green energy and so forth, there is a fair amount of bipartisan support for. We start talking things like, corporate tax changes and things like that. Of course, that's going to be, warfare on both sides to try to win the day. So we could see a pattern here if Senator Manchin and others can broker these bipartisan deals to get things through we agree on. And I'll just say one more thing is that we know post-pandemic, this world we live in is changing. I mean, people are driving more. We're asking ourselves, what's the role for transit and how that's going to change? Are people going to take transit more or less? What if fuel prices go up? And so I think the key is not to try to make every decision all at once here as, the society tries to rebuild itself after a terrible pandemic.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Algoma. John, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up, John?
Well, I think it is absolutely ludicrous that anybody who is involved in the workforce or benefits from the workforce should think that it would be the responsibility of families, underpaid families, to pay for childcare, when in the Western industrialized nations, childcare is viewed as a necessity. And in fact, it should be a necessity provided by the employers if they want people who also have a responsibility for caring for children to work in their workplaces. Failing that, given that women throughout the country rallied in 2016 for the Great Women's March following the prior presidential election. I think that family members, one family member who works in the workforce, in every family in America should not go to work one day a week and call it Family Infrastructure Day.
I gotcha, John. Thanks a lot for the call. Joe, John making the argument, I think, that the Biden administration is making, that if we think of infrastructure as things that allow for the free flow of the American economy, why not count something like childcare as part of that, that allows people to go to work without having to worry about paying for childcare?
Yeah, I think, you know, we talk about the elasticity of the word infrastructure. You know, that's where a lot of people do, you know, I think, correctly say, okay, let's call it what it is, you know, and this clearly is a policy designed to, you know, solve a social problem that's often connected with infrastructure. But unless you're building childcare centers, you wouldn't call it infrastructure itself. You know, that said, I think the president's been sort of clear about, you know, why he's defining infrastructure more broadly than the common term. But the speaker will raise a really good point there, that the research is really clear, regardless of what party you're affiliated with, that, you know, when child education suffers, there's long-term impacts of that, and investment in poor families, marginalized families that don't have resources for proper child care pays off socially. And just today we heard, you know, the checks soon are going to come out with a new child care credit that's been included in some recent legislation. So lower income families and even middle income families are going to get a check, you know, as a way to compensate them for the cost of raising kids. So there always is some policy underway about that, but the speaker is right that there's a lot of momentum to do more. But it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out.
Thanks for that call, John. We're talking to Joe Sweeterman from DePaul University, looking at infrastructure in Congress, infrastructure across the United States as well. Joe, I want to get into the climate change side of things here. We heard Senator Warren saying it didn't do enough, left green energy behind, she said. And there's kind of like there's two ends on this. On the one hand, concerns about, you know, our transportation infrastructure, for example, contributing climate change pollutants and making the problem worse. Also, we hear about things like heat waves, like are going on now in the West, challenging electrical grids. So causing and suffering from climate change at the same time. What are your thoughts on including climate change efforts in infrastructure plans?
Yeah, this certainly is closer to the traditional definition, and that transportation and electric production and so forth all connects with the efficiency of the system, how we run the grid and so forth. And I do think this summer it really has been, eye-raising just to see these terrible temperatures out in the Pacific Northwest. We just had a call this morning where the internet was disrupted and appears to be because of the extreme heat. So everybody, I think, sees that, particularly on the energy side, there's a lot the federal government can do to make us more efficient. We saw a push recently to phase out some coal plants. The question is how fast we go so we don't hurt the economy. I think that's where the parties differ on it, that Republicans would say take a go or slow approach because of the, you know, the hardship that's going to cause if we try to do things too fast. But I will say that things are really starting to happen on the technological side that create opportunities, you know, with airplanes that are new biofuels, fuel-efficient cars, electric cars that we saw Tesla turn itself around, and now is a really efficient producer of electric vehicles. The prices are finally coming down on that. And on the power side, you know, we're seeing a lot of innovation there by producers as well. Here in Illinois, we got a tough question about the nuclear plants, what we do with those, which are low emission but have other problems. But federal leadership in that area, I think everybody agrees, is pretty key right now.
Politically, Joe, do you think it's harder to sell big spending on maintenance of infrastructure versus building something new and exciting, like we're going to subsidize a transcontinental railroad, or we're going to build a big hydroelectric dam or an interstate highway system? Is it just less sexy to talk about maintenance?
Yeah, well, I look back at the late 50s and early 60s and even the 70s, and just the way you could sell infrastructure was so exciting. And we're going to open O'Hare Airport, and we're going to have a ribbon cutting, and the interstate highways opened, and new transit lines. And now it seems, you know, we're it's harder to sell the public on, you know, we're going to modernize the power grid, or we're going to invest in charging stations, you know, because it's often hard to separate the rhetoric from the reality, and people get skeptical, thinking you're going to just launch either a progressive agenda or an anti-progressive agenda, and there's actually devils in the details type things that people don't trust, where you see a new airport, you can point to it and say, that's what you're getting. So it's that's where this gets so tough, that we it seems like the parties can't even agree on the basics here. That, you know, again, that said, I do think the progress we saw this week, even if we end up with a $579 billion package, that's going to go a long way. We're going to see interstate highways resurface. The, you know, the Hiawatha corridor up to Milwaukee could get a piece of the action there with better service. Of course, there's a lot in there about you know, pipes and electric grids and things like that that just can help buffer our climate change problems.
Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Joseph Sweeterman is a professor in the School for Public Service, Department of Public Policy, and Sustainable Urban Development Program at DePaul University. Talk to him about an infrastructure deal reached by President Biden and a handful of senators from both parties, and the prospects of a wider reaching infrastructure plan being pushed by progressives. Well, in just a little bit, we'll hear about one possible infrastructure bit of spending in Milwaukee, plans to try to replace lead pipes and remove lead paint as well. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we want to hear from you. It is summer job season for the youth. Have you ever worked a memorable summer job, for better or worse, in the past, recently? Maybe you have one right now. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What was your favorite summer job you ever had? What made it so good? We'll take your calls in just a bit. You can get started now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a new poem from a Milwaukee writer.
Finding forgiveness is deeply personal. Sometimes it's easy to forgive someone who's wronged you and move on. Other times, the road to forgiveness is long and bumpy. But what if forgiveness isn't an option? Writer Deshaun McKinney of Milwaukee is exploring this in his new collection of poetry, Father Forgive Me. He shares one poem from that book on forgiveness.
Somewhere you read forgiveness and dreamt about killing a man. You hear forgiveness unburdens and check that the knife is still by your pillow. Sometimes you feel sorry and remember your father's words, how you suck in your stomach in mirrorless rooms and take pride in no one believing you were ever that big in your resurrection. You tell yourself that you are a man now, but every night, write a hymn for the boy who tried to scrub his stretch marks into oblivion. You think of what he would have been if worshipped, if celebrated instead of sacrifice. Wonder what to set upon an altar for sensitive black boys. Regret the threat of the knife, but polish the metal, reset it anyway, having learned young that sensitive black boys were fighters of the world's accord. Learned young that you would have to unlearn your tears, but learn how to store them for one day. You remind yourself that it's never too late to get an education. Hope one day is less tomorrows away when you awake. Next to the blade will be a letter addressed to black women, handwritten. For fixing you plates of collard greens and pig's feet as large as the table, calling you baby and weighing your report cards heavier than the digits on any bathroom, hallway, living room scale, you tell yourself you are a man now. that you say I love you to the homies without context and hope it sounds as soft as you believe love needs to be. On the most tender nights, you scroll through memories of smiles, hugs, travels, and sex to preempt the dreams. You wake to the stillness of 4 a.m., having read about forgiveness somewhere, and forgive yourself for having trouble finding it.
That's writer Deshaun McKinney reading his poem on forgiveness. He explains the inspiration behind that piece.
This poem was really coming from a space of just thinking about the idea of forgiveness. You know, so often when we experience some kind of hardship or trauma or betrayal or whatever it is, we're often told that forgiveness is the path to move forward. And like, it's almost as if that's what you have to do or you're supposed to do. And that's the only way to heal from something. I think of it as an interesting idea of, well, it's never that simple. And I think we so often force people into it that idea of me having to forgive can also be harmful in some ways. And I'm of the mind that that's not necessarily the only way to move forward. So for me, when I was writing this poem, I really wanted to just kind of grapple with the complexity. What does it look like when you hear these things, I should forgive, or I read about forgiveness as the poem says, and I'm actually having trouble getting to that point of forgiveness. And just kind of what does that look like?
McKinney's poem is part of a greater collection of his work called Father Forgive Me.
The book is called Father Forgive Me, and it's really a book that grapples with and nuances generational traumas. And it's really figuring out how does it affect you? How does it follow you through your life? I wanted to present different time periods and different scenarios of how it impacts you, and then wants to grapple with that idea of forgiveness, and which really pairs down to what do you do with these experiences and this trauma, and how do you move forward? And so it's, these poems all have that through line of that journey of you experience this thing that is very impactful on your life, and you're carrying this weight, and then how do you move through the world, and where do you go next? And really about how do you live with things that have been imposed upon you. I think that's kind of what I hope to get across with this book.
Writer Deshaun McKinney is from Milwaukee. He recently released a new collection of poetry called Father Forgive Me through Black Sunflowers Poetry Press. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, summer is here. School's out, and it might be time for a summer job. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite summer job memory growing up or recently, or do you have one right now you could tell us about? Was there one you weren't looking forward to but ended up being really memorable? Was your favorite part of working summer jobs, or have you had one that wasn't so great? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to a caller right away. Sam is with us in Duluth. Sam, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What's your summer job you want to share with us, Sam?
Yeah, I worked at a summer camp for the YMCA for a while. That was really fun.
Now, I know a lot of people graduate from going to a summer camp to working at a summer camp. Was that you, or was this something you came into kind of from the outside?
Oh, yeah, that was me for sure. I definitely was the kid who went as a camper and then graduated up to becoming a staff member. It was really fun.
What was your favorite part of working at the summer camp, Sam?
Yeah, it was really fun just teaching kids how to play some games, having fun, singing some campfire songs, doing some campfire cooking, and of course, sailing and canoeing and stuff like that.
Fantastic, Sam. Thanks for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Asking you to tell us about your summer job memories, good, bad, or otherwise. 800-642-1234. Asked around the Central Time producers, JC, J. Carlisle Larson says, my favorite summer job in air quotes, was when I house sat and dog sat for multiple families one summer, made a pretty significant amount of money, hung out with cool dogs, and took care of some really nice houses. JC says, recommend it. And Rachel Vasquez had a mostly summer job in high school timing 5K, 10K marathon races. She said it was hard work with way too many sweaty people for her taste. It's hard work. You're just working the stopwatch, Rachel. Come on. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with your summer job memories. Janie is with us camping right now in Wisconsin. Hi, Janie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What job did you want to tell us about?
My favorite job ever was the summer before my senior year of high school. I was a lifeguard at our small town pool. So every morning I would teach swimming lessons, and I would go home for lunch, come back and do lifeguarding in the afternoon and evening, then teach adult lessons in the evening. And one of the lifeguards was a diving coach, and he would teach all of us guards how to dive after the pool closed.
Cool.
Well, it was fabulous.
Janie, I'm hearing we actually had a conversation about this. There's a lifeguard shortage in Wisconsin and around the country. Do you ever think about, picking up the whistle again?
I think that train has left the station already.
All right.
Well, I think my whistle has been retired.
Well, at least give a plug for the kids today. You talk them into getting out and lifeguarding.
Yes, I think we need to. I think they probably make more now than 75 cents an hour.
I hope so. I really hope so. Janie, thank you so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Taking your summer job memories, still time for you to call if you dial quickly at 800-642-1234. Got an email from Kristen who says, my weird summer job was assembling fishnets, not the tights, nets that actually catch fish. It was done by hand. I made minimum wage. Tying knots to various hoops and lines, definitely a unique experience for a high schooler. Wouldn't exchange it for my current job. All right, that sounds good. That's a unique one. Natalie Guyette, Central Time producer, had a very brief summer job where she rode a bicycle with a cart on the front of it around trying to sell sandwiches and drinks to local office buildings. This is not Natalie's own business. She worked for someone else. It was a very heavy bicycle, and the selling was slow. Dean Knetter says, more of a week-long gig than an actual job, but I watched the neighbor's peacocks while they were on vacation. I didn't read this one in advance. They didn't go hungry, and I maintained good relations with the birds. This was a success. I'm learning something new about the Central Time team. I don't know if he was a peacock wrangler. My big summer jobs is 16 and 17. I worked at a swimming pool and pool table store. A lot of it was like unloading chlorine trucks. Got to watch out for those leakers. Got some chlorine in the face there. I'll tell you about my other one in a minute. Let's go to Carmen now in Richland Center. Carmen, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What was your summer job memory, Carmen?
So I had two that I feel like are unique to Wisconsin. One was at a cheese factory for a summer, and one was at Summerfest, which actually doesn't happen the whole summer. It's only for a week, but I made enough money to last the whole summer.
Awesome, Carmen. Those are very Wisconsin-specific jobs. Thank you so much for sharing those with us at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Julia now in Madison. Julia, hi.
Hi. Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was just finishing my freshman year of college, and I thought, well, I'd want to work at a camp here in Wisconsin. So I went up to an area where on campus that you could look for jobs. And I saw a job listing for the YMCA of the Rockies in Estes Park, Colorado. Ooh. And I got chosen for a job. I got just this amazing job working there and had the blessings of hiking all over the Rocky Mountains. And it was just an unbelievable summer.
Julia,
it was the best thing I ever could have done.
That is fantastic. Thanks for sharing that. Well, I'll wrap up with my other summer job at my pool store I worked at. I met a guy who was in a band that played bars, and they could use a sax player. So I was like 16, 17, staying up till 2, 3 in the morning playing in bars that I probably couldn't legally actually enter, come to think of it, playing cover songs for grown-ups, and it was the best money I've ever made as a musician in my life to this day. We'll recreate that sometime, hopefully. Well, thank you so much for your calls and emails. You can keep sharing your summer job memories. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up, we'll check in on efforts to reduce lead in Milwaukee homes and talk about the difference that millions of dollars in federal aid could make. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, when all sports stopped last year, one Englishman used the long hours under lockdown to write a love letter to his new home, the U.S. Men in Blazers host and TV star Roger Bennett talks about soccer, citizenship, and his new life in the USA. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the city of Milwaukee is set to get close to $400 million in aid from the latest round of federal COVID-19 relief. That's the 12th highest amount of funding per capita going to a major American city, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. So what should the city do with the money? One idea, getting lead out of homes. Our next guest recently wrote that the funding is being seen as a historic opportunity for the city to reduce the amount of lead, paint, and pipes. Allison Durr covers Milwaukee city and county government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Allison, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Talis Shelbourne is an investigative solutions reporter for the Journal Sentinel. She covers affordable housing and lead issues. Talis, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Talis, remind us, how big of an issue are lead paint and lead water pipes in Milwaukee right now?
It's a serious issue, and trying to mitigate the lead exposures has taken quite some time. There are still 70,000 lead pipes, still a lot of old housing stock that has lead-based paint. So it's still a very serious issue, and people are being affected by it every day.
Allison, do we know how much of this federal money coming to Milwaukee would be directed toward getting rid of lead in paint and pipes?
Exactly how much is going to be allocated to lead is still up in the air. The city received $394.2 million in federal funds from the American Rescue Plan Act, and local officials are hoping to see more from the infrastructure bill that is currently kind of being discussed at the federal level. So we don't know at this point exactly how much will be allocated or could be allocated to lead pipes and lead paint in the city, but it's definitely something on local leaders' minds.
Tell us, before we dig more into the funding, let's talk about lead and kids in particular in Milwaukee. Could you talk about the problems we've seen when it comes to elevated blood lead levels? How widespread is that problem?
Yeah, so in 2018 in Milwaukee, roughly 19,000 children between the ages of 0 and 5 were tested, and roughly 1,700, about 11% of that, had blood lead levels above 5 micrograms per deciliter, and that is the rate at which the CDC states that that is a concern, and there, you know, it's reason for intervention. So it is a significant problem here in Milwaukee. Children have affected cognitive abilities, impulse, and hyperactivity, and so it's something that pediatricians and just doctors in general are concerned about for kids' long-term well-being.
And we're coming, Talis, out of this pandemic. Do we have any sense that kids' exposure to lead was changed by the pandemic, maybe just by virtue of being at home more?
Yeah, I mean, that's relevant to two issues related to the pandemic. One is that children were learning from home, were spending more time at home, playing outside where there could be contaminated soil from falling lead paint chips, as well as the fact that a lot of parents were keeping children home because clinics hours were changing and it was difficult for them to get them into an office for lead testing. So we don't even know yet what the impact was. And that's something that a lot of doctors are concerned about as well.
Talking to Talis Shelbourne and Allison Durr from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at lead exposure in Milwaukee in paint and pipes and the possibility that federal relief money could help the city tackle that problem. Allison, when we look at the scope, the number of homes with lead pipe intakes, the number of homes with lead paint, how does this amount of federal money stack up against the amount of money it would take to fix all that?
You know, unfortunately, it is a much larger cost than the $400 million or so that the city is slated to receive. So the current estimate puts the cost of replacing all lead service lines in the city on both public and private property at nearly $800 million. So that's twice the amount that the city is receiving in American Rescue Plan Act funds. And I think the important, I guess, thing to keep in mind here is that lead is not the only place that city officials are looking to spend this money. So it's one of a host of priorities that also include eviction prevention, internet access, and early childhood education.
And Allison, no matter how much money we throw at it, it takes work. I mean, it takes people who know how to do this kind of work. Do we have the people in place to be able to use this money to get the lead out of these homes?
That is the big question and the big challenge with this funding. You know, even if the city were to throw millions and millions of dollars toward lead pipes and lead paint, as we've heard from city officials and you know, and people in the trades and who deal with lead paint and lead laterals, there just aren't enough people at this point to do this work. So I think that's a big piece of this conversation, is how do they get enough people you know, on staff, both at the city and with contractors, to actually start making significant progress. And some of those things really do take time.
And tell us, we're talking about how this federal money could be used in the future. As I understand it, though, there are existing community efforts already trying to get rid of these sources of lead. What kind of things are already going on?
Yeah, so there are community organizations that are working with the health department, looking at prevention efforts, looking at education efforts. So that's letting especially parents with new children, newborns, know about making sure they have water filters, especially if they're using formula and they're mixing that with water, or they're mixing the formula with water that could potentially be contaminated. Also letting them know about renovations. If you're doing something like that, that can kick up lead dust, which is also a contaminant. So it's really, they're doing a lot of education and trying to prevent more cases in the future as we try to deal with the current issue and the current children that are being affected.
Allison, did I read this right? At the current pace of remediation, actually removing the pipes, getting the paint out, the current pace would mean that it would take something like 7 decades to cover every house that currently has lead in Milwaukee. Did I read that right?
That is the estimate from the city, yes. So at about 1,000 of these lines, lead service lines a year, it would take the city about 7 decades to replace all of them. That's nearly 70,000 lead service lines that still exist in the city. So, I mean, that's the pace that things have been kind of moving at, you know, and it remains to be seen how this funding could, you know, could help increase that pace. But as I said, it takes time to train people to, you know, replace those lead service lines. And then there's also a deadline on using this funding. So it's not like, you know, they could use it into 2027, 2028. They really need to use this funding within the coming years.
Tell us, I wonder, I mean, we look at the price tag. It takes a lot to remove these lead lines or to remediate paint. Do we have a sense of, like, the cost, the financial cost of health impacts of lead?
Yeah, so that is not something that's very well known. We do know that it does have effects on children in school as they're learning. And so there's a lot of negative health effects that do have, I'm sure, significant collateral issues that they cause. But I'm not sure that they've actually done studies on, you know, what it costs essentially to be lead poisoned financially. What we do know is that there are significant costs to homeowners who want to replace their portion of lead service lines. And there are also costs to getting a lead certified contractor to come and deal with lead paint in your home. So those are definitely concerns that people and residents have about trying to deal with lead in their immediate vicinity.
Allison, when it comes to a timeline for deciding how to use the existing federal money for lead or for other purposes, do we know when these kind of decisions would be made?
I would expect in the coming months that there will be decisions, you know, that the city will start making as it relates to spending this money. There is a survey that is out, and I think it's available until Wednesday this week, where residents can, you know, put in their priorities and tell the city what their priorities are for this funding. And so I think after that, we'll probably see more movement in terms of determining where this funding is going to be spent.
And tell us, as we wrap up, you focus on lead issues. What are you watching for next in Milwaukee?
Yeah, I'm reading my colleague Allison's reporting to figure out how this money is going to be spent. I'm watching the community efforts, the health department's efforts. And I do want to mention that we do have a lead resource guide for anyone out there who has concerns about lead in their home. It has information about testing and healthcare and abatement and mitigation and all those sorts of things. And I'm interested in that as well. And then seeing the new numbers, you know, after this pandemic of how many children have elevated lead levels. Those are all things that I'm keeping an eye on.
Talis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting us on.
And Allison, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That was Talis Shelborn, investigative solutions reporter who focuses on lead issues at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Allison Durr, who covers Milwaukee city and county government for the Journal Sentinel, both with us today to talk about the impact that federal funding could have on efforts to reduce lead in Milwaukee. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, the Federal Reserve plays a big role in the U.S. economy. But what is it? What does it really do? Get the basics and then meet the leader of a Midwest regional branch of the Reserve. That's tomorrow at 8 on the morning show. Up next, antitrust legislation making its way through Congress for big technology companies. We'll check it out. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.